Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We are joined by former United States Senator Claire McCaskill from the state of Missouri. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much, Senator.
My pleasure, Charlie.
So Missouri politics is almost as interesting as Wisconsin politics these days.
Yeah, it's a little nuts here right now.
It is a little bit strange. I have to ask you about this quote from the acting governor, which is one of those things where you look at and you go, okay, he didn't actually say that, right? He couldn't possibly have said that. What is this? Parsons, is that his name? Parson?
Yeah, Parson.
Yeah. Said that school children will get COVID-19 and they will get over it. So I guess so he's saying that the decision to send all children back to school would be justified even in a scenario in which all of them become infected with the coronavirus because they'll just get over it. He actually said this. This makes sense to some people in Missouri.
You know, he got there in office. He was a good old boy, a sheriff from down in Southwest Missouri that was in the state Senate and got elected lieutenant governor. And then our governor got caught taping up his mistress with duct tape on gym equipment in his basement and was run out of Jefferson City by the Republicans, I might add, not the Democrats. And so then Parson became governor, and he basically is just trying to do whatever he thinks Trump would want him to do. He is a total acolyte. He sees his entire future, political future, and his election is in November. He's standing for election for governor for the first time. He sees it all tied up with Trump. So he just tries to be as Trump-like as he possibly can. And I think he really succeeded in this instance. So he said something inane and stupid. I mean, a little bit like injecting bleach or putting a light bulb in your mouth.
Yeah, we have to look forward to this, right? They're bringing back they're bringing back the 5 o'clock follies today. What could possibly go wrong?
It's very interesting to me because clearly Kellyanne Conway has won, Charlie. She believes that he needs to quit ignoring the coronavirus and embrace more his leadership role. I see her fingerprints on his recent conversion to being seen in a mask. And I see her fingerprints on starting these the 5 o'clock follies again, and we'll see how he does. But I'm betting that he continues to dig a hole he can't get out of because I don't think he can help himself.
Okay, so I have to ask you this. I was thinking about that I was going to be talking with you today, and you and I have never met. I don't know that we've even been on shows together, although you know that's certainly possible. But it strikes me that being a United States Senator is a very cool job, and I'm sure you loved being a United States Senator. But it also strikes me that you're having a lot more fun right now, aren't you?
I feel guilty. I'm having so much fun. You know, being a United States Senator as a Democrat in a state like Missouri is really, really hard work. Getting there is really hard work. Staying there is really hard work. And most importantly, the work is hard. You know, you never quit. You go 24/7. So it's kind of bizarre to me in some ways. First of all, I've discovered there's a whole world out here I didn't realize existed.
Amazing.
And secondly, I'm getting paid real money just to mouth off. And kind of a dream thing for me. I get to say exactly what I think on a fairly consistent basis on a fairly major platform. So who could not love this? I am having a blast, and I hope along the way I'm doing some good, but I certainly am having fun.
So that's what I thought you were going to say, because when you're a senator, particularly from a state like Missouri, you have to weigh everything you're saying, you know, and you can see when senators are being interviewed, you know, behind their eyes, they're calculating, what can I say? How is it going to be taken? How can I be taken out of context? What's the blowback going to be? How can I phrase this in a less controversial way? And now it's like you've broken through the chrysalis, right? And it's like, I got nothing to lose. I'm going to say exactly what I think. That's an amazingly liberating experience. I mean, you must look back at your former colleagues and think, wow, I spent all of those years not saying what I actually was thinking.
Well, I frankly did it more frequently, I think, than many. I'm a real fangirl of Harry Truman because he was so plain spoken. And by the way, he wasn't that popular when he was president.
No.
His polling was terrible when he was president. Other times it was a little better. But I got in trouble with some frequency for what I said in Missouri and frankly how I voted sometimes in Missouri. But it was always stressful, even when I said exactly what I was thinking, it was stressful. And now the stress is gone. So I don't care. I mean, the best is all the haters on Twitter, saying, shut up. I go, make me, it's like, right. No, I won't.
Okay. So let's dive into this. Let's talk about what's going on in the headlines today, because I know you have some things to say about Portland. This is an extraordinary story, particularly because the president is seeing what's going on in Portland and going, I like that so much that I want to have that take place in cities all around the country. And the acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf is completely on message. You heard what he said yesterday. I want to play this and get your reaction. This is, again, Chad Wolf, who has never been actually confirmed by the United States Senate as the Secretary of Homeland Security. And I'll be honest with you, when I saw this video, this was, I think, probably the first time that I even knew he was in that job. But this is what he had to say.
8 hours are just misinformed. They're not accurate. They don't understand the authorities and the responsibility the Department of Homeland Security has. We protect over almost 9,000 federal facilities across the country. We did that 10 years ago. We did it long before this civil unrest started, and we'll continue to do that. And so I don't need invitations by the state mayors or state governors to do our job. We're going to do that whether they like us there or not. That's our responsibility. Now, first and foremost, we want to work with.
So we're going in whether they like it or not. I don't need invitations by the state, mayors, state governments to do our job. Senator McCaskill, your thoughts?
Well, I think people, one of the things that's frustrating for me, keep in mind that I started my career as a state prosecutor. A lot of Americans have not spent a lot of time thinking about criminal jurisdiction in this country. The vast majority of crime in this country, over 95%, is prosecuted by state and local prosecutors. The FBI, the federal law enforcement, they don't respond to 911 calls. And what this guy is doing, he is trying to usurp local control by claiming that if they can go in anywhere and grab people off the street because there's a federal building in that community. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, Charlie, very many Republican conservatives that I have met in my life, and I have met a ton and been friends with many, that would ever accept that complete distortion of our constitutional rule of law in this country. The feds are not allowed to go into communities with a fig leaf of, oh, you've got a federal building, so we can come in and do whatever the hell we want. That is not a conservative principle. It's not a libertarian principle. And certainly in this instance, it's not something that even people that are left of center are going to accept. This is a situation where you've got a president who's got it in his head that somehow he's going to win re-election if he can be tough enough on people who are spraying graffiti and starting fires. And I don't advocate spraying graffiti or starting fires, but the feds never come around for an arson case. That's a state and local case. They don't come around on graffiti painting. That's a state and local case. So for them to come in with this big boot and say, we're here, we're going to restore order, just for the guy in the Oval Office to preen and posture politically makes me sick to my stomach. And the thing that really makes me sick to my stomach is the incredible silence of my former colleagues in the Senate. Where the F is Rand Paul?
I think he actually did put out a tweet, believe it or
not. Okay, well, God love him.
I think, but he would be the only one as far as I can tell.
Yeah, but where are the rest of them? Can you imagine what those guys would be doing if Obama had rolled in to communities in America with Customs and Border Patrol in camo to take people off the street. I mean, these guys would lose it if the roles were reversed.
I think that's fair.
I think about a lot of things right now, whether it's deficit spending, whether it's the debt, whether it's the stimulus, you know, all of these things that it's just like these guys are hiding under a rock, and I don't think they're going to come out. And I don't know how they have any credibility when they finally do come out, Charlie.
Well, especially the thing, you know, states' rights, federalism, local control, all of that seems so last century right now. So, but let me be the flip side of this, of course, is that, yes, these are state and local matters, but you have officials in places like Portland where it appears that they basically stood down the police. They are not really aggressively enforcing the law. So the rationale you're going to get from Trump world is, look, you have actually lawlessness and chaos. If they're not going to do the jobs, we're going to step in and do it for them. So to a certain extent, isn't this a challenge to some of the mayors who seem to have a hard time knowing how to push, how to handle and react to the violence?
Yeah, and here is the challenge for those state and local actors. If having been on the ground and seeing a lot of active protests, particularly in the days of Ferguson and other conflicts in my state, there is such a very delicate line to walk between the peaceful protests that by and large occurred during the day and some of the bad actors that come out after dark and actually break the law and do property damage and throw bottles or rocks at the police. How you address those bad actors without making the problem worse is the challenge. And there's no question that what Trump has done in Portland has done nothing but grow these protests. It hasn't shrunk them. It has just made them get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger they are, the easier it is for bad actors to hide among all the good people who are out there exercising their First Amendment rights. So I agree that mayors should not say lawlessness is okay, but having the right training to go in and excise those bad elements and get them out in a way that doesn't make the problem worse is the challenge they face. And I can assure you, Mr. Acting, basically staffer, Hill staffer lobbyist, Chad Wolf, has no sensitivity to how that is. He's just doing what Trump told him to do, to go in there and be the big badass. And so I really think this is where you need to really have good cooperation between whoever is trying to enforce the law and the people who really are peaceful and just want to protest, and because they can be helpful in this situation. He is putting pressure on mayors, and that's not all bad. On the other hand, this is using a 2x4 when a surgical instrument is what's needed.
Okay, I want to come back to this point in a moment, but you mentioned something that continues to puzzle me. The Chad Wolfs of the world, the guy's been in this position as an acting secretary because the president is not putting up a name for the United States Senate to confirm. There was a time, wasn't there, when senators had a certain pride, a certain jealousy of their own powers, that they would have regarded this sort of thing as an insult to their prerogatives and their role in the constitutional system. As a former senator, can you give me some insight into why I get the silence, how they don't want the presidential tweets, but why as an institution has the Senate been so willing to be rolled like this?
I think Mitch McConnell is deserves a lot of the blame here, and I'm not somebody who fails to recognize that this door has swung both ways. You know, it was in fact Harry Reid who first took the 60 vote margin down to 51 for certain appointments. But I really am shocked at the lack of institutional loyalty that I see on the part of particularly some senators like Lamar Alexander, who's retiring, and Mike Enzi, who's retiring.
Right.
And those are two really good examples They should be standing up for the institution, but they all are standing up to try to hold on with everything they've got to the majority. And they know that the more they stir the pot within the Republican Party, the less likely it is for them to hold on to the majority. Mm-hmm. And also, I've got to put a lot of blame on Ron Johnson. I mean, you know, it is just an embarrassing situation that he is the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. You know, Susan Collins, when she was chair, and when Joe Lieberman was chair and she was ranking, it would have never been this way. You know, John McCain was on that committee. He would have been demanding a hearing on what's going on right now at Homeland Security with Customs and Border Patrol basically abandoning the border to go in, make score political points in major cities in America. So it is terrible that, you know, that it is what it is. And I don't know if the institution recovers, because what I'm worried about is if the Democrats take over this fall, and I, for one, believe they will. Will they try to emulate this, especially if we have a Democratic president? Or will they go back to the days where I used to do all kinds of oversight on the Obama administration? I called out Obama when he fired an IG, even though Obama is a good friend of mine. I knew it was my role to, as somebody who was very involved in the inspector general community, to call him out when he got rid of an IG without following the proper procedures. Well, this guy flushes IGs like, you know, many of us.
Well, you know, your reference to Ron Johnson's kind of a gut punch for me, because, of course, I've known him here in Wisconsin for some time and remember what he was when he first came into office and how I thought he was going to be sort of a Republican version of William Proxmire, somebody who wasn't going to buy the Washington insider establishment bullshit. And instead, he has become. He's not just Trumpified, but as you point out, I mean, he's head of the, you know, major oversight committee, and there's so much going on. And instead, what is he doing? He's issuing subpoenas about Hunter Biden. It's like a cartoon version of oversight, and it is embarrassing, and it's a very strange story from my point of view. Okay, so can we flip back to the politics of what's happening here? In Portland, because I mean, it's obvious that what in Trump's mind, he wants to run as the law and order candidate. He wants to be the guy that, you know, dominates the streets and returns, you know, strong, et cetera. But by spreading this around the country, he really runs the risk of replicating what happened at Lafayette Park in District of Columbia. And outside of Trump's own head, I think most people see that as a negative turning point in the Trump presidency when he used tear gas and pepper spray against peaceful demonstrators so that he could have a photo op. So the risk, of course, is that you're going to have these images of, you know, over, you know, his fetish for force played out again over and over and over again. So give me your sense of this politics, because, I mean, obviously, the president is flailing in the polls. He's got a limited playbook. And I understand that law and order will play with his base, but using these federal, these, you know, anonymous little green men, federal agents in cities across the country strikes me as bizarre if you realize that Lafayette Park was a really negative turning point for him. Do you follow my point here? Is that, you know, he thinks that was a success. It was a disaster. So he wants to replicate that around the country. Wow. What could go wrong?
Yeah. You know, and I was thinking about this when John passed away last week. And I think about the turning point of the civil rights movement, and it was really television. It was the thuggery and the unacceptable behavior of law enforcement in beating up peaceful protesters that really turned the tide. In the Pettus Bridge was a turning point in so many ways because people saw it on TV. And now everyone has a camera in their hand. And so it is going to be very difficult for Donald Trump to control the images. That's what he thinks. This is all some kind of reality TV show, and he can control the images. Mm. And you can see the naivete about that with this march over to awkwardly hold a book he's never read for a photo op. And I think it is a mistake. If law and order was going to work, he wouldn't be flailing in the polls like he is. And by the way, American people aren't stupid. They see him pardoning all these people.
Yeah.
I mean, a law and order guy is not, you know, saying, well, it's okay to lie to the FBI. And a law and order guy is not saying, I'm going to make sure my buddy Roger Stone never goes to jail. A law and order guy doesn't, you know, pardon Joe Arpaio. He doesn't, you know, pardon the corrupt governor of Illinois. He doesn't do that, a law and order guy. And so I just don't think this is going to work, but I think he's running out of plays in his playbook. And in his head, he thinks it's brilliant because after all, everything he thinks of is brilliant, right?
You made an interesting point there that, you know, he does think of politics as a reality TV show, but he was used to being the executive producer where he got to write the script and he got to choose what the images are. And this is a situation where you don't. So, for example, in Portland, the viral video that's coming out is that Navy veteran who's standing right there being beaten with batons and then tear gassed. That's not the kind of image that he would have chosen for the Trump show, the new episode of the Trump show. Okay, so on the issue of police reform, you know, we have seen a major shift in public opinion in support of Black Lives Matter, willingness to acknowledge the racial problems of the police department. But I'm sure you saw this poll that came out from a Washington Post ABC poll that on the issue of police funding, 55% of Americans oppose moving funds from police departments to social services. 43% say they oppose it strongly. It's one thing to reform the police. It is something different politically to use a phrase like defund the police. Where do you come down on this?
Well, I think it's a terrible phrase because it certainly implies that you're wanting to remove resources from the community. And, you know, I this is one place where Joe Biden, I think, has forgotten to remind people. I was the elected prosecutor in Kansas City when we had a huge crack cocaine gang problem, record homicides, and a huge methamphetamine problem. And that's when he passed the crime bill, which included not only funds for us to, for the first time, have victim services and victim advocates, but we also got money for community policing. And we actually installed community prosecutors at that time. And I think what Joe Biden is interested in doing, and if you look at his proposals, he is not defunding anything. He's actually putting resources in a way that the police are not just sitting in a car responding to a call, but rather they have a job and an obligation to get to know the people of the community, to get to know the community leaders, to go to the community meetings, to talk to the community about what they're worried about and what they're scared about. I mean, one of the biggest problems with homicides in America in urban areas is getting cooperating witnesses. And to get cooperating witnesses, there has to be a level of trust. So rebuilding that trust has to be a foundational part of this. And do we need more mental? I mean, police spend a lot of time picking up people who are self-medicating because of mental health issues. We just turned a lot of mental health problems out into the streets when we shut down, you know, all because everyone was disappointed in the efficacy of large mental health institutions. But we didn't really follow up and make sure that we had appropriate mental health services. So that's a way to free up resources for the police, is to get them out of the business of responding to mentally ill people who've not taken their medication, who are homeless. So there's a lot of ways that you can, without it sounding soft and somehow against the community, to reform police. It's been done in communities successfully. And one of the reasons it hasn't been done, Charlie, and hasn't maintained that is because it's more expensive.
It is more expensive. So how has Joe Biden handled this? I mean, obviously, the Trump campaign is all in on saying that he supports defunding the police. It's not true, but you can tell that this again is going to be a major theme of the Democratic the Republican campaign. The Democrats want to defund the police. Has Joe Biden pushed back hard enough on that?
I don't know that he has at this point, but I think it's still early. You know, that there will be the debates. Chris Wallace did a great job pushing back for him on Sunday.
Yeah, he did.
I mean, Chris Wallace probably did more good than Joe Biden could ever do by giving a speech or issuing a press release or touting his plan. I think most people know that Joe Biden doesn't seem like the kind of guy that's going to close up police departments around the country. So that's the problem that Trump has with Biden is people know Biden. They know he's not some, you know, he's Joe, you know, he's, we know who he is. We know his values. We know his character. So it's going to be hard to turn him into something he's not. They did a number on Hillary Clinton. And, but I think they're clearly struggling with trying to play that same number on Joe Biden.
They are. So let me ask you about, this is a obviously a speculative question, but I was talking with a Democratic fundraiser over the weekend and just talking about various scenarios. And this person was worried about a couple of things that might happen between now and November. Top of his list was the possibility of a Supreme Court confirmation fight. Now, not talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there have been rumors that perhaps, and again, this is just a rumor, I have no inside information whatsoever on all of this, is pure speculation, that Clarence Thomas might step down in order to give the president a seat on the Supreme Court, which would be a huge distraction from the coronavirus, exactly the kind of thing that he would want to rally his base to do the whole Kavanaugh thing all over again. So give me some sense of how powerful that would be if there was a Supreme Court fight in the middle of this, as if 2020 has not been lit enough. Can you imagine what that would do to the country to have another one of those confirmation fights in the midst of all of this?
Well, I think it would, if Mitch McConnell tried to do that.
He would, right?
I guess he would, but he would know somewhere in the deep recesses of his mind, while him doing what he did to Merrick Garland delivered him the majority. I think if he did it now with 100 days left of the election, it would definitely dethrone him as majority leader. I believe the Senate would definitely go to the Democrats if, in fact, Mitch McConnell tried to ram through an appointment within, it would have to be, I mean, even if Clarence Thomas resigned next week, the vote would be probably within 30 days, just the Senate calendar and what they can do with the calendar. The vote would be within 30 days of the election.
Yeah.
Or even worse, maybe after they had been dethroned.
Is there any doubt in your mind that Mitch McConnell would push through a Supreme Court confirmation during a lame duck session? I'm sorry.
It makes me sick to my stomach. He's just so bad. I guess he probably would try. But I think the country would recoil. And the question is, what about some of the Republicans? Would they recoil at that point if Trump had been defeated and they had been defeated? Would Rob Portman, would Pat Toomey, would they go along with that?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? Whether or not you would have some of those who have nothing to lose at all be willing to go along with all of this. I mean, they've shown a willingness to do it up until now. But so let me ask you this, because you mentioned your feelings about McConnell. I mean, there once was, and it was probably not true, but at least there was the narrative and the image that the Senate was the most exclusive club, and that even though you might disagree with one another, that people maintained a tone of civility and cordiality. Just give me some sense, though. It feels like that's broken down, that the way that senators deal with one another, the language they use with one another, the way they drag one another on Twitter, that really has done damage, not just, you know, personally, but also institutionally. I mean, let me ask you this directly. I mean, were there some of your colleagues that you just couldn't stand, that you couldn't talk to?
Not very many. You know, everybody has a great deal in common that are there. With a few exceptions, there is higher than average IQs. With few exceptions, there are people that are intellectually curious and kind of policy wonks. With few exceptions, most of them are people of goodwill that like people. You know, you don't embark on a job career where your entire measure of success is whether or not you're accepted or rejected in the public most way possible if you don't like people. So I think there still is friendships. I still maintain communication with some of my former colleagues that are Republicans. But on the other hand, there has been a real tearing up of the middle. You know, when I first came to the Senate, there was a healthy group of bipartisan senators that weren't afraid to call themselves friends of compromise. They weren't afraid to call themselves moderates on both parties.
It wasn't a dirty word.
And it has become a dirty word in today's politics because our media has gotten so segmented. And that's one of the reasons I have been encouraged by some of the conservative voices like yours, Charlie, and others that have been willing to speak out against some of the things that are going on that are not normal, that are not good for our country, even though they are being done by a Republican president. I hope that some of that will carry forth into the Senate once the Trump era is over. I don't know that it will, because you get in trouble if in your primaries, if you're in a tough state. If you are part of a group that looks like you're compromising. And the irony of this is people who want to talk about the founding fathers and our Constitution, it's like they forget that that very process was one of compromise. I mean, the whole way we got the Constitution were people hammering out compromises. Our government is designed to actually promote compromise because, unlike most democracies, The executive branch is not controlled necessarily by the same party as the legislative branch. The founding fathers were wonderful evil geniuses, right? Because they wanted there to be the people have a chance to send one party to Congress and another party to the presidency. They thought that would in fact encourage more compromise. And instead, right now, we've gotten to a massive amount of dysfunction. So, and part of this I blame on the business community. You know, the business community provides a lot of the money in politics.
Yes.
And they decided that they wanted to play red shirt, blue shirt. And when you play red shirt, blue shirt, you're going to get a lack of middle and you're going to have a lot of the big problems of the country not going without being solved, because you don't solve the big problems without bipartisan compromises. You just don't do it.
So what do you think that Republican senators, you named some of them, Republican senators who've been around, who have institutional memories, who still remember when there was that period of compromise, what are they saying in private? What do you think they're thinking about being lashed to the mast of Donald Trump going into this election? I mean, for 3 years, we've been talking about how what people say in private versus what they are refused to say in public. So what is it like, do you think?
I think most of them are miserable. I think most of them feel trapped. You know, if you just go back and look at what some of them said while they were campaigning against Donald Trump.
We remember.
We remember. And, you know, I think of some of the private conversations I had when I was still in the Senate after Trump was elected. Private conversations I won't repeat, but with people like Ben Sasse and Lindsey Graham and many others. So there's going to be two camps going forward. They're going to be the camps of longtime institutional senators who have who may want to go back to some kind of institutional norm. But then you're also going to have some senators. I mentioned Pat Toomey and Rob Portman. They have elections coming up. You know, is Pat Toomey going to run again in Pennsylvania? You know, he's got a problem. North Carolina, you know, you've got a situation where there's a good chance that you're going to send another Democrat from North Carolina back to the Senate. Will the remaining Republican senator from North Carolina take heed and decide that maybe compromise is not such a bad thing and working in a bipartisan way is not such a bad thing? You know, I always look to states that have one Democrat and one Republican. Because those are states where you are most likely to get something done in terms of people working in a bipartisan way.
So how are you feeling about the presidential race right now? I ask everybody this question. We all know what the polls are saying. I have yet to meet a Democrat who is feeling cocky and overconfident about this. I think everybody still suffers from PTSD from 2016. But you're looking at these numbers. You're looking at you have an experienced eye at going to the crosstabs and everything. What is your feel about the state of the race on July 21st?
Yeah, true confession, I read crosstabs like novels. I know. It's a genetic defect. What can I say? It's not healthy.
Yeah.
Here's what I see. I see a real problem that Donald Trump cannot recover from with women. I see a real problem in the suburbs where he's taken to saying that Joe Biden wants to destroy the suburbs. Well, that's, you know, complete poppycock. I mean, people know better, and that's not going to work. But here's the crosstab I look for most often, if I can find it. They don't ask this on every poll, but every poll that asks it, I take a deep dive. Mm-hmm. And that is the voters who say they can't stand either candidate. Mm-hmm. In 2016, there was a huge number of voters that couldn't stand either candidate. Trump won those voters, by a healthy plurality. And right now, Joe Biden is winning those voters by a much larger margin than Donald Trump did in 2016. And those are the voters, that number of voters will increase before the election, not decrease. Our presidential politics creates enmity towards our candidates. By the time election day comes, there's a lot of people, what I call the hold your nosers. And we're going to have a large group of hold your nosers in November. And I think what's going to kill Donald Trump is his personality, his ego, his lack of empathy, his inability to be humble, his throwing out the norms. I mean, the day I knew that I really knew that I didn't think Donald Trump could get elected was the day he had Kanye West in the Oval Office. And Kanye West said on live TV, said MF from the Oval Office. Now, we're talking about the Oval Office where people got upset that Obama wore a tan suit. And Donald Trump sat right next to him and smiled when he said MF on live TV in the Oval Office. Now, people don't like that in America. That makes people very uncomfortable. That makes Trump voters uncomfortable. So I think the hold your nosers are going to win the day for Joe Biden. And I think he's going to end up with over 400 electoral votes.
Really? You do?
Yep, I do.
Because we're talking about that particular metric, and I remember back in 2016, there was a point at which when 62% of Americans did not like Donald Trump, and I remember saying, "There's no way that you can be elected president, except if, of course, if the other party puts somebody up who's also disliked by 60%." I mean, and it's going to be like that again, as you point out. We're going to dislike both of them, but there's something about Joe Biden that it makes it hard to viscerally dislike him in a way that I think Donald Trump is viscerally disliked. Plus, there's nothing he can do about it. Nothing he can do. So you're going out on a limb, 400 electoral votes.
Yeah, and I think the margin matters here, and I think Democrats know it. And I've never seen people this emotional about voting within my party before. I mean, we all, you know, were very inspired by Barack Obama and the notion our country could do that, could elect Barack Obama president was so exciting to all of us. And there was a huge turnout. But I do believe that while Trump has an enthusiastic base, it will be matched, I believe, by the enthusiasm in the base of the Democratic Party. And then your hold your nosers will, I think, give Joe Biden a dominant victory. At least that's what I'm saying. And I'm going out on a limb, but I want it very much because a big margin will make a big difference in how this country moves forward and heals, not just internally, but also the way we are viewed by the rest of the world. It is very important to our standing in the world that we correct this mistake in a way that sends a clear signal that we're back as friends of our allies and people who hold Kim Jong-un and Putin accountable and all the other bad guys out there.
Well, and also the margin is important because it would potentially avoid what would be one of the worst constitutional crises we would ever have experienced, given the fact that the president is clearly laying the groundwork to challenge the legitimacy of the election. He's tweeting just this morning about the mail-in votes and how they are fraudulent and how it is rigging the system. So he's clearly invested. In that interview with Chris Wallace, he was given multiple chances to say that he would honor the results of the election. I think we pretty much know that if it's close, that Donald Trump is going to claim that it was stolen from him, and question whether or not the mail-in votes were largely fraudulent. So again, I mean, so how worried are you about that?
Well, he did that in the last election, yeah, and even though he won. You know, he said he followed that up with the largest inaugural crowd ever, when the pictures clearly showed America what a liar he was. He's now somebody who is not trusted by the vast, vast, vast majority of our country. So I think, honestly, I think he's setting all this up because I think he wants to, my own personal opinion, I'm speculating here, and I have no basis for this whatsoever, but I think he wants to buy OAN Network and go after Fox and become a little media mogul for his base.
I think he'd be happy with that if he didn't face the prospect of being indicted. Okay, so wonkier, will there be another pandemic stimulus package before the election? Will they get that done?
It'll be very interesting to see. You've got some real problems with you've got the president pretending like he has some support for a payroll tax cut. He doesn't have support for that in the Republican Party in the Senate. So that's not going to happen. So you've got him posturing on that. You've got Mitch McConnell wanting to do a blanket immunity from all lawsuits, no matter how egregious conduct might be, which I think is also going to cause people pause. I mean, the right to a jury trial is a constitutional right. People need to remember that. This is something that's in the Constitution that for ordinary folks to be able to challenge the system is not an un-American concept. And I think then you've got some people wanting there to be more money. And then you've got the Republicans, all of a sudden, there seems to be some kind of, they're thinking in their heads, wasn't there something about overspending somewhere where we really have a problem with debt and deficit? You've got those folks. So it will be interesting to see if Schumer and Pelosi and McCarthy and McConnell can pull this together. They will do it in spite of the White House, not because of the White House, if they can pull it together. I can't tell at this point. I'd say that the chances are 50-50 right now.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, of course, there are millions of Americans who will fall off a fiscal cliff if the money runs out, if they don't, you know, continue the unemployment insurance and a variety of other things. And that I would think that the fear of that would focus the minds. But as you point out, there are some very, very significant differences. And apparently the Trump White House was against giving states more money for coronavirus testing and tracing, which strikes me as absolutely ludicrous. So, yeah, you're probably right about 50-50. Claire McCaskill, thank you so much. This has been very entertaining and very insightful, and I appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Charlie. Great to be with you.
And thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast today. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.